Guys, how's the form? Episode 4 of The Ditch in collaboration with Red Wolf Media. Owen McNeil here, joined by Roman Shorthall on my right, Paulie Doyle on my left. I missed the memo about black and hats today, but onwards we go. We've got a good bit of chat here for you this afternoon. We're going to be talking about the EU from a left perspective. We're going to be talking about what some would call the revolving door between Irish media and government. And we're going to be talking about a man who did the state some service. Simon Coveney, who will not be running for Fine Gael in the next general election. We're also going to be joined by the new Assistant Press Secretary, Ciara Phelan. She's going to be joining us later on to talk about her new role with Simon Harris. Stick with us for that. We've got a great show ahead of us here. First off, we're going to talk about Mary Lou McDonald. She was giving an address, an Easter address, and she said that for too long, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have been too deferential to the EU. This encouraged a wave of hysteria among EU flag shaggers. one reaction that kind of stuck in my head was from Panty Bliss, who said, "What kind of Tory light shite is this?" So I'm going to ask you, Roman, can you criticise the EU without being a Tory?
God, that's a deep question. Yeah, of course you can. But I think, like, in Ireland, we have this weird kind of dynamic where even people on the left, like in other countries, wouldn't really, just generalizing, but wouldn't really kind of have an issue with, like, you know, they'd be fairly open about criticizing the EU when it needs to be criticized. But here, like, it seems to be like a kind of almost like a taboo subject.
Why do you
sometimes
think that is?
Say, like, for different reasons. I mean, to be fair, like, I think, you know, statistics have shown, or surveys, like, that Ireland is, like, a reasonably, like, pro-EU country, or, like, certainly in the top few countries in the EU, you know, in terms of our views, like, on, you know, how beneficial the EU has been. But, I mean, it's kind of like, I think it's similar to how a lot of the people you're talking about that got angry, it's similar to kind of how they view our relationship with the United States. Like, it's the same kind of crack, like, that, you know, we just have to, you know, we just have to do what we're told, like, and be happy.
Well, it's funny that you should say that about our relationship with the US, because, like, a term that has, I'm quite fond of, it's kind of entered the mainstream and in certain online communities, we talk about yank brain. I always think that when Irish people talk about the EU, we're afflicted by Brit brain. You know, post Brexit, during the Brexit campaign, obviously there were pockets of a left wing Brexit, right? There were people like Dennis Skinner, who was pro-Brexit, Mick Lynch, who was pro-Brexit, and he still gets a load of shite for it. Well, they kind of tried to make that a thing with Mick Lynch, you know, when he did become a kind of a darling of the left. People try to dredge up his past of being pro-Brexit and a bit to discredit him. There were pockets of a left-wing argument for Brexit. Obviously, they were totally beaten out by, look, it was a reactionary conservative campaign to leave the European Union. It was, you know, it was defined by lies, exaggerations, falsehoods, mistruths, whatever you want to call it, you know. Having seen that, and having seen the people who are most commonly associated with Brexit, people like Boris Johnson and the right of the Tory party, people obviously like Nigel Farage, I think a lot of Irish liberals, particularly in the leafy suburbs of South Dublin, they kind of look at that and go, "Oh well, we're not like those bad guys. We love the EU." Like, you know, if you were to make a left wing case against the EU, where would you start?
Well, it's a neoliberal project that I think we've talked a little bit about this before, that was actually founded to facilitate the free flow of capital, right? And it was, you know, there are restrictions around nationalizing industry, which are very problematic for countries that say want to, you know, ensure that their inhabitants have living standards, or that the, you know, their resources aren't in private hands. And recently, increasingly, the European Union is militarizing its economy as a way to stimulate growth, which is very problematic because, you know, there's going to be incentives there for the European Union or the Europe as an alliance to wage war, you know, in order to sustain itself financially and its economy.
It's funny that you should say that about it, how the why the EU was established. I remember it was Web Summit 2019. I was there as an attendee and got chatting to, he was a journalist from an English publication, and you know, the first question he asked was also, how do you feel about Brexit? Which, first of all, actually, that drove me mad as well during that. It was, you know, during the Brexit campaign, in the aftermath of Brexit, you'd meet an English person and this is all they'd want to talk about. Like, you know, like, you know, like, what do you think of Brexit? Yeah. It actually annoyed my brother so much that he started doing this thing, like, an English person would ask him, oh, so what do you think of Brexit? And he would just go, what's that? And they'd have to go like, oh, well, Britain is leaving the EU. And he's like, oh, so exit. Oh, great, okay.
It was all everyone talked about for like 3 years, maybe just until just before COVID.
It became a very important part of lots of people's identities. But yeah, at Web Summit 2019, this English journalist, and he's asked me about what I thought about Brexit. And look, for the record, I said to him, I was like, look, if it ever came down to it, and if Ireland was subject to a similar right-wing reactionary campaign as the Brits were subjected to, yeah, I'd vote for Ireland to remain in the EU. Like, to be clear, I think like leaving the EU is politically neutral. Like, you could leave the EU and say that we want to leave the EU because we want to nationalize industry, because we don't want to be complicit in the deaths of thousands of people in the Mediterranean every year. You could do that because we don't want to be complicit in the material support that the EU gives Israel.
Yeah.
You can do that, or you can do what the Brits did and you can leave because you don't like foreigners, you know? So like, I was kind of saying,
you want passports a certain color.
Yeah, but like, I was kind of saying this to this English journalist, and you know, words to that effect, and I said that, you know, look, I'm a socialist, so I'm not particularly pro-EU in its current incarnation. Yeah. I kind of narrowed his eyes a bit and goes, what does you being a socialist have to do with what you think about the EU? And I was like, oh, well, you know, it's a neoliberal project. And he was like, how is it a neoliberal project? And then I was kind of like, you know, like when you're asked a question like that, it was kind of like, it's like being asked to describe how water is wet. Like, you know, it's like, right, let me put the pipe down, like, and let's go and get into it, you know? But I mean, do you think that, I mean, first of all, who do you think Sinn Féin were speaking to when Mary Lou McDonald made those remarks? I mean, like, the only, I will say, like, you know, I think it's fine to criticize the EU, obviously. I think it's, you know, best when you do it from a left perspective. My only kind of gripes would be that I think she referred to Ireland's taxation policy, its immigration policy, which I'm kind of like, who is that for?
Yeah, I mean, look, Sinn Féin have in recent weeks and months gone to the right on immigration. It's quite clear from the rhetoric of their politicians and some of the things they've been like publishing, and like the things that are going around from door to door and that kind of a thing. And they've also previously said that they're in favour of our corporation tax remaining the same as it is. They've also been in favour of low corporation tax in the north as well. You know, it's difficult. I mean, I don't think that they're criticising, say, something like us being increasingly militarily aligned with the EU, because there's a piece in the Irish Times last year that reported that Sinn Féin had actually removed its pledge to remove Ireland from permanent structured cooperation, PESCO, which is the Europeans' joint kind of defence initiative, commits us to contributing to all kinds of funds to do with like weapons research and weapons development, and then also you know, defending EU countries if they're involved in military operations and that kind of a thing.
On the taxation, how do you feel coming from the left? Obviously, there have been, there is the Apple court case that the state is still appealing. There are repeated noises from EU circles about looking to force Ireland to raise its corporation tax rate. How do you feel from the left about these calls?
Well, it's kind of hard to analyze, I think, what she said without kind of like, I think someone would have to maybe, you know, journalists would have to kind of pull her up on it and just ask, like, what exactly did you mean when you said taxation? Because I know there are, it's possible that she was speaking about, like, there's specific rules about budget surpluses and stuff like that. I mean, was it definitely about the corporation tax rate?
Not necessarily, yeah, to
I
be
mean,
fair.
I mean, it could be, like, given that, you know, I think in recent months, like, there's been a lot of kind of chat from different quarters in Sinn Féin about, you know, investment and foreign investment and stuff like that. I recall, like, an interview, I think, that Piers Doherty might have done in the Business Post a couple of months ago, maybe last year.
This was in The Independent. I have to say, that was a funny interview where I actually think he was maliciously misquoted by The Independent. They went with the headline of something like, you know, Piers Doherty says Ireland is opening its doors to American multinationals, when you kind of drilled into what he actually said.
I think it was even worse than that. I think it was like, big business knows that Sinn Féin isn't going to take them on. It was something even like that.
But that wasn't even what he said, to be fair.
Oh, no, I'm saying that was the headline.
Yeah,
that was how they misrepresented him.
Are they going to take them on, though?
I mean, like, what can you do with these American multinationals as well, though?
Well, I mean, I think the problem at the moment is that I saw a report recently, may have been a study, where a massive percentage of our corporation tax is coming from just two companies. So, I mean, what do Sinn Féin do, like, when they come into power? If they, you know, if they were to fuck around, like, with corporation tax or whatever, and they lose that money that comes in, like, they have to find a way to replace it. And, like, that is going to be difficult. Like, there's no, you know, obviously, like, a lot of people on the left would have, including myself, would have big problems, like, about corporation tax and, you know, the way Ireland is used effectively as a tax haven by a lot of these companies. But on the other hand, like, from a practical point of view, Sinn Féin are going to be making a lot of promises in terms of housing and things like that. So, you know, they'll have to have some sort of a plan to replace that income that's coming in from corporation tax.
Well, like, the country is effectively addicted to corporate tax receipts that is fundamentally based on this, not only the corporate tax rate of 12.5%, but these, whatever you want to call them, tax vehicles or mechanisms. We've talked about it in another episode. Some of them, the brainchild of Fergal O'Rourke, which allows these companies to pay effectively, 1%, 2%, less again?
1 euro a year.
1 euro a year. Yeah. But, like, the country is effectively addicted to it. It's been a central plank of the path that the Fine Gael-led austerity government chose after the financial crash of 2008. One thing that I find kind of ironic about, again, to go back to the reaction to Mary Lou's comments, you had EU flag shaggers saying, look at Ireland's GDP pre and post joining the EU. Yeah. Which now, okay, so the first thing is, like, look, I mean, there's an argument to be made that a relatively young country that is in the process of, you know, some level of industrialization, enjoying, you mean
a highly educated, English-speaking
country. But like, you know, a developing country as well, you know, relatively newly independent, that's, you know, well, you will enjoy these jumps in GDP regardless. It just happens because of those processes. And people would, you know, people would often point to China and India, which obviously, you know, chose two very different paths, but, you know, on paper enjoyed relatively similar leaps in GDP along the way. With Ireland then, you know, like, first of all, I mean, what would you say? To put it bluntly, our GDP is a crock of shit that is, you know, built on, you know, the onshoring of intellectual property in Ireland and, you know, just like non-productive capital really more than anything. But what I find kind of interesting is when the EU flag shaggers will invoke our GDP, which is, you know, post 2010, you know, it's, you know, it's like, the best thing you could say is that it's bolstered heavily by our tax haven status. And you know, that's what we've, you know, whatever recovery that we've enjoyed after the bank bailout, it's been totally reliant on these corporate tax receipts. And, you know, to be clear, Ireland bailed out our banks $64 billion. In the words of Vincent Brown, we bailed out unsecured bondholders to which the Irish public have no relation. And, you know, we effectively, look, we can talk about, you know, the reasons, the official reasons why the banks were bailed out, but it, like, in reality, we did it to save British, French, and German banks, you know? I do very much think that we're considered the whipping boys of Europe. You know, that acronym PIGS, that's no mistake. You know, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, Spain. The fact that they went for PIGS, that was no accident. Equally then as well, like, we were supposedly the good little boys of Europe and we took our medicine and we did everything right. Now you have kind of at an EU level, like, you know, the means that the country used to enjoy some level of recovery, well, now they want us to go and change that. So it's kind of, what I'm saying is, it's kind of hard for me on the left, where on the one hand, of course, I don't like Ireland being a tax haven. At the same time, I'm like, well, this is the path that we took for the benefit of, yeah, like, you know, to put it bluntly, British, German, French banks, you know?
Yeah, and I was just remembered, like, there's another graph that people, the flag shaggers, as you call them, share. Like, it's the one where Ireland's labour productivity is like 2.5 or 3 times higher than the UK. You know, like, we're at the top of this list, and it's like, you know,
this is a Mark Henry style graph.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. Everything is great.
Everything is amazing.
Have you not considered that things are great in Ireland? I'd be on
Have
me
you
on
not considered
Martin's
that I live in Malahide and things are absolutely fantastic?
How many times have you got tuberculosis in your life?
Have you not considered that things are going really well for me and my friends? So maybe you should be happy about it.
Yeah, like, it's just, and like, you'd see people like, you know, Fine Gael TDs retweeting this like every so often. Like, I just laugh because I just don't know, like, how anyone, and maybe, look, maybe they don't, like, they don't, maybe they don't seriously believe that, like, that's, you know, that we, like, we just, we're so good, like, that we work like 2.5 times better than the Brits. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's insane, you know? Like, it's clear that it's because we're a tax haven. Like, Luxembourg is up there, you know, towards the top as well.
They'd be very culturally Irish, though, and hard workers.
Like. Hard workers, yeah.
And sure, love a pint of Guinness and the whole... Yeah.
And didn't Leo Varadkar say that, you know, he wants to help people to get up early in the morning? Oh, maybe we just get up earlier in the morning than the Brits.
Like, we've said, yeah, that leaving the EU is a neutral act. Equally, a federation of a federation of countries is also, you know, a neutral entity. It can be a left federation of countries. It can be, I keep saying companies, and that's a Freudian slip as well, given what the EU is currently incarnated like.
Are you proposing a Soviet Union?
Well, that's why we should be in the EU, because the Russians are going to come for us otherwise.
And we need more guns.
But what I wonder, though, is, you know, I mean, one of the, you know, I kind of don't like to get, believe it or not, I don't like to moralize about things, but I have to say one of the rankest, most disgusting utterances in Dáil Éireann for me was when Brendan Howland said, "Who speaks of Syriza now?" It was just after Michael Noonan had announced yet another austerity budget, and we were being the good little boys in Europe. We were taking our medicine, and, you know, back in 2015, Syriza, you know, had been elected on. I mean, there was real hope about that project. Obviously, it absolutely flamed out, you know, after that Greek death referendum, when the country, I mean, I remember at the time I was up on the North Coast, and I remember the night of the election, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, Ireland stands with Greece, which I took part in. The Greek people had been subjected to this absolute wave of fear-mongering, you know, saying, if you don't accept this austerity, we are going to fuck you, basically, is what they said. And I remember thinking at that time, you know, it was a landslide result. They went no oxy. And I just thought it was, sometimes there is just on a very simple level, just a simple act of saying no. I just thought it was amazing. Obviously then the EU came down like a ton of bricks on them, humiliated them, you know, absolutely humiliated them, had to accept an austerity package worse than what was on the table. Michael Noonan was a big part of that as well. He was, you know, over, because obviously Fine Gael didn't want these uppity Greeks to have, you know, to be seen to get a better deal than we, the good little boys of Europe, got, you know.
They took pride in the fact that there was a single country that was got a worse deal than us. At least not those fucking guys, you know.
Yeah.
That's how committed they are to being good little compliant neoliberal Europeans, that they're willing to just, there's one country that got fucked over more than us, and they're like, ha, now, see? Yeah.
But part of, if we, with the very clear caveat, what the fuck do I know? You know, at the time and in hindsight, I always thought that Syriza's mistake and where they failed was they were too committed to the European project. Obviously, with their history of having been ruled by a fascist regime in the 20th century, the Greeks take their democracy very seriously. They took being part of the European project very seriously. There was never really any, you know, even just from a kind of a strategic perspective, there was never a real credible threat that they would leave or could leave. It was always like, oh no, well, we're here for better or for worse. And obviously Varoufakis then kind of sailed off into the sunset afterwards when, you know, he couldn't accept that deal. What do you think, you know, the Greeks obviously committed to a reform of the EU rather than, they never seriously considered leaving. Do you think the EU can be reformed?
That's a very difficult question. I mean, it doesn't look good right now.
Give the caveat, what the fuck do you know?
I mean, it doesn't look good, does it, at the moment?
Things are not
looking great at the moment. I really don't know. I mean, gun to my head, my gut would say no, but then what does the world look like if you dismantle something like that that's been there for such a long time? And what would take its place? I don't know. What do you think? Can it be reformed?
Would we be looking at a Yugoslavia-style situation?
Like, what would reform even mean? You know, because, like, the principles that it was founded on.
Sending von der Leyen to prison would be a start.
Fried
genocide. Yeah, just send her away.
That would be good. I'd be happy with that.
As a
kind of reform.
Get the ball rolling.
So, the other big story this week has been the announcement that Ciara Phelan, former political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, has taken up a new role as the government's assistant press secretary. I'm going to ask you, Paulie,
why didn't you get the job?
Why didn't you get it? No, I'm actually going to ask you, why should I care about this, or why should I be angry about this? Because I think we have a slightly different opinions on it.
Well, it's just it. I suppose it, the act of her taking that job is, you know, whatever. But it's, I suppose it's typical of the relationship that the media has with the government. Or we were talking about this a little bit earlier. There are all these kinds of...
Don't hold back, Polly. Let it all out.
There are all these kind of incentives and reasons for newspapers not to be critical of the state of the government. One of them is direct advertising revenue from government departments or from the state itself. Another is things like the no VAT, you know, break that newspapers got. And then in the third one is actual employment prospects for senior journalists in newspapers who can basically ensure that they get a pension if they land one of these jobs. On top of all of that, a lot of the journalists actually just share the same opinions as the politicians, as the politicians themselves. So, I mean, if you care about power being held to account, then, you know, it certainly disgusts me that this is the media landscape.
Do you think power is held to account by the mainstream press?
No.
Next question.
Yeah, I mean, like, no. I mean, and certainly not by, you know, there are some excellent journalists in mainstream, and a lot of the time they are hamstrung by editors or, you know, decisions, more strategic decisions being made in the background about, you know, should we be running this? How is this going to affect X, Y, and Z? And but like when it comes to political correspondence, arguably they're the worst at holding politicians to account or holding the state to account. I think like the relationship is far too cozy and far too close. We've spoken before like about the little WhatsApp groups that they have, like where, you know, they're given stories like by politicians in advance, and you know the stories are divvied up, and they're never stories of consequence. They're just like press releases, basically. Like, and that's it. So yeah, no, I don't think
the stories that they get, if they weren't leaked to them, the government would have had to just issue them as a press release the next day anyway.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
like the scoop that you get is just actually saving whoever the comms officer is day's work. Like, you're pretty much just doing their job for them.
And then you've a big queue of mainstream kind of colleagues who will be saying scoop, you know, and it's like you know.
So like they broke the story about Leo leaving. Fiona Sheehan broke the story about Leo stepping down, but he broke it like 20 minutes before he announced it. So yeah. And people were like, great scoop.
That happened with the Simon Coveney story.
Yeah.
Simon Coveney issues a tweet at exactly 10 o'clock in the morning saying, I'm out. And then 2 minutes later, he said, a story is published by Fiona Sheehan at 2 minutes past 10. And then, like, next thing, like, Gavin Riley is like saying, this is a scoop. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like Fiona Sheehan has been, you know, working away in the background for months on this story, like, and it's a big, like, you know, it's a massive story when, like, in reality, Simon Coveney may very well have just sent him a text and saying, look, I'm out, by the way. That's the story, you know?
I think we're all on Simon Harris's press list. We get his fucking press release.
I never asked to be on it.
Yeah, I think I think if you email his department, you just get stuck on the press list. Like.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're on it.
I redirected it to spam because I don't know, like I couldn't, I think it's some issue like trying to block it. So I just redirected it to spam.
Redirected to these nuts, like?
These nuts, yeah. But then I almost missed a comment from that department because it ended up like pushing everything from that department into spam. So now I've had to take it out of spam, and I'm again getting Simon Harris press releases.
But we got one, like, it was on a Sunday night, and it was like, you're under embargo.
Oh, yeah.
And it was literally, oh, yeah, Simon Harris is going to Washington tomorrow.
I'm announcing €20,000 for Greystones.
It's quite mercenary as well, though. Like, if you're working in media and you're, you know, supposed to be just, you know, writing about politicians or identifying wrongdoing on their behalf, and then you just go, no, actually, I'll do the opposite, and I'll be a fucking spin doctor for this guy now, and I'll actively try to undermine the media. And you guys have had run-in with these guys before as well, haven't you?
A couple of them. First story we ever did was Micheál Martin attending a prohibited event during COVID. And obviously, when we published that, we didn't even have on the Ditch email addresses. I was sending a request for comment from my personal email account, you know, and did all of that. Didn't get any responses. And I remember it was Good Friday, and
not for Micheál Martin.
Good Friday, and we put up a teaser tweet where we put up a thing of, you know, it was the first tweet, we had zero followers on Twitter, and we were saying, tomorrow, 9 a.m., full story kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I was having a steak with my old fella and my brother, and next thing is, phone rings. And it's Paul Clarkson, former editor of the Irish Sun, then the government press secretary. And I'll say this, but you know, recently the Irish Times did that piece about meet the special advisors, you know?
Yes.
And it was a ridiculous article. It was, the fawning over special advisors was just ridiculous. You had these Irish Times journalists, seven of them bylined on the piece, you know? And I remember, like, it was all things like, you know, this person has a very impressive CV, and oh, this person is considered a shrewd political operator around Leinster House. They were so nice about everyone. And they got to this guy, Paul Clarkson, and they were like, had a bit of a rough start, but he's kind of all right now. So, like, not a popular guy around Leinster House. Sorry, Paul. But anyway, like, he calls me up, like, and he goes, yeah, hi, Owen, like, and he basically tried to, like, alpha dog me. And I was kind of there going, like, all right, pal. Like, he rang three times on Good Friday, and I was like, I'm the one having a beer with my old fella and my brother here, like, and you're the one who Micheál Martin is told to, like, repeatedly call me and try to get more information here. So, like, but yeah, he at one point was there going, like, he's there going, like, listen, Owen, I'm not trying to be funny here, because he's from the north himself, like, and he's like, I'm not trying to be funny here, but I've never heard of you. I was just like, and in my head I was kind of going, yeah, like, I've heard of you because you worked for the fucking Sun, like, you know? And so it's like, I'm happy enough that you've never heard of me, you know? That was one of them. The other one who was, I have to go back and see what the Irish Times said about him, Pádraig Gallagher, guy from County Clare, who is, you've heard bad things around, I don't mean bad things, like, just bad things that he's an arsehole, basically, like, you know,
yeah,
around Leinster House, like. And, like, yeah, the dealings I had with him was, so if you go back to...
Is that what it said in the Irish Times piece? That he's an arsehole?
He's an arsehole. Pádraig Gallagher's an arsehole.
The government source said he's an arsehole.
But, like, this was... You might need to correct me on this one, but I think this was in the... Was this in the aftermath of Robert Troy's resignation?
I think so.
And, you know, part of the whole Robert Troy affair was, you know, there were questions about his RTB registrations, I believe, weren't there?
Yeah.
And look, to the, or not necessarily to their credit, but, you know, the Irish Times did, I remember, I think in the aftermath of Troy's resignation, did do a big front page story about government TDs who were landlords and whether they were registered with the RTB. Now, we had a follow-up story on Stephen Donnelly, and we were ready to go on this. He has a rental property in Sandyford, wasn't registered with the RTB. So we had this story, it was ready to go, it was written up, and we email his office, and we get this email back from Pádraig Gallagher. ex-News Talk guy, right?
Ex-arsehole.
Current arsehole. And, yeah, you know, he was nice as pie, very professional, you know, going like, hi, Owen, yeah, you know. I'd given the deadline, it was whatever, like 4 o'clock, whatever. And, yeah, he emails back and he says, yeah, working on something on you, working on something for you on this. Just wondering, could we have a little bit more time? And then, because, like, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I am such a nice guy. I'm so sound, like, I'm so sound. And I said to him, I was like, yeah, grand.
Sweet.
I'm sound, but I'm stupid, as you will see from how this goes. Like, because then, yeah, like, right enough, then his new deadline passes and he emails back, he goes, could just have a little bit more time? And I was like, yeah, of course. I'm really sad.
Take as long as you want. Yeah.
And next thing is, you called me, and then you're like, story's dead. We've been scooped. And of course, what happened was, Padraig Gallagher, Stephen Donnelly's press advisor, he emails us a statement, you know, and then right as soon as he had sent that statement, the Irish Times, Jennifer Bray, had a big scoop. Like, Stephen Donnelly isn't registered with the RTB. Story did really well for them. But, like, what happened there was, Padraig Gallagher goes, oh, fuck, we don't want to give these assholes at the Ditch another story here. So, went around frantically looking for someone in the mainstream to do it. And yeah, Jennifer Bray was the chosen one, basically. She got the story, like, you know, happy to help, Jennifer. So, like, but that's the kind of, yeah, work that these kind of spads do, you know.
That's why they pay him the big bucks.
Big bucks. But yeah, then since then, yeah, so whenever we do a story in Stephen Donnelly, we just text Padraig Gallagher and say, yeah, we're publishing now, and publish 5 or 10 minutes later, you know.
Yeah. I mean, in general, like, we give people a lot of time to respond. Like, I would know of cases, like, where sometimes, like, politicians are given, like, an hour or two to respond to a story. But, like, in general, we'd usually, like, sometimes it might only be, like, 4 or 5 hours, but usually try, like, to contact them in the morning and give them till the end of the day, or just depends, like, on the urgency of the story. But yeah, Stephen only 5-10 minutes because of that.
Because of poor.
Yeah.
Why do you think journalists become special advisors?
Money.
Do you think that's it?
I'd say that's the main reason. I mean, like, you're looking at kind of anywhere between, I think, 75 grand and 110, but they go over that limit as well, like, if you're really special.
You see, I think money is a factor, but this is where I kind of a little bit differ with you guys. Maybe.
Power.
Well, power maybe, but, like, you know, I kind of, like, I was joking about, you know, Louis Althusser, who is a French philosopher, wrote a pretty influential essay called On Ideology, where, you know, he lays out these theories about what he called ideological state apparatuses and repressive state apparatuses. So these organizations and infrastructures that the ruling class use to spread its ideology, right? So in the case of a repressive state apparatus, obvious example would be the police, right? The courts.
So you can't be saying that now.
So, like, say, for example, you know, when the guards, whatever, they're so sensitive about this. Like, when they attend at an eviction, or if they assist at an eviction, you know, there is the threat.
That's not true, Owen.
What is it?
They just observe.
But if they're there, right, there is the implicit threat of state violence on people who resist eviction, right? The threat of repression, and this is the enforcement of ruling class ideology on say property rights, right? So that's a repressive state apparatus. Then you have ideological state apparatuses, which Althusser would say schools, NGOs and think tanks and media, say like, or like Althusser talked about communications organizations, right? So I would agree with a lot of his thinking on this. So then I would kind of look at the media as being an extension of state. So to me, it's like, yeah, well, of course, guys are going to go back and forth. They're doing that job anyway. And they quite likely agree with the, like, I do think that a lot of these special advisors are true believers. Yes, the money's nice, but I kind of think that, you know, even the years that they were working as political correspondents, I think that they agreed with the ministers they were covering and, you know, had a kind of a fundamentally endorsed that whole political project. So to me, it's kind of like, you know, and to say people like Louis Althusser, like, would just say, oh yeah, of course. Of course she's moving to this role, you know? But do you think it's just about money?
Pretty much. Like, I mean, I think it's just money and maybe, you know, the opportunity to be close to power, you know?
Well, we are going to be joined by Ciara Phelan later on, so stick with us and we'll find out why she's taken up that role. We're going to move on to another Fine Gael TD who is sadly leaving us, Simon Coveney. Polly, when do you think Simon Coveney did the state most service? What was the best thing he did for the
state? It's a toss-up between his time as Minister for Housing and his time, his lengthy period as Minister for Defence. I don't know. There's just so much service involved here that it's difficult to narrow it down.
I think the best service he ever gave was appointing Paul Hyde to the Marine Institute.
Yes.
Who was later convicted and sentenced to prison.
When we published our first stories on board Planola and Paul Hyde, myself and yourself had chats about, obviously, a part of that story. Paul Hyde, who has now been convicted, who had to resign in disgrace of on board Planola after a series of stories that we did. We talked at reasonable length about the Simon Coveney connection, and, you know, both of us had spoken to people who had said, I mean, look, we had both been told they were best friends, you know, they were best. Obviously, they co-owned a yacht together. Yep. But both myself and yourself, you know, despite what people might say about the ditch, we made a conscious decision to sort of not ham up that part of the story. It was actually, I remember Arthur Beasley in the Irish Times, I remember he did a piece and I was like, wow, like he really went for the friendship angle. And they really were, like, I mean, absolute.
Oh, like there's pictures of them in the news archive, like with their wives, like on a yacht. Like, you know, this is going back like over two decades, I think. Like they were childhood friends, like from that scene, you know. That yachting scene.
And what do you think, you know, I think in the fullness of time and everything, I think, you know, no Simon Coveney, no Paul Hyde. No specific Paul Hyde. I do think he was anointed by Fine Gael to do a particular job. And I think we can say it was the Coveney connection that kind of got him in there.
Yeah, well, like Coveney appointed him to his first state board, and then I don't know how, you know, what exactly went down when Phil Hogan appointed him to on board Planola. I mean, he's an architect, but, you know, so are thousands of other people. But yeah, like Hyde got the job, and then Coveney, when he was housing minister, sat down with property developers and...
Michael O'Flynn was on RTE and basically suggested, wouldn't it be great if big developers could apply directly to on board Planola rather to local authorities?
Yeah, and Simon Coveney granted his wish, drafted up the legislation, got it out very quick, and his best friend was appointed to the strategic housing division, and that was Paul Hyde. He was made chairperson of the SHD division, and you know, we know what he got up to. There's stuff that's still being investigated, stuff where, you know, nobody can explain how every single decision on particular telecommunications masts were approved. Like, the probabilities of that happening are very slim. So, like, it all points in one direction. It's a direction that, for legal reasons, we can't get into in too much detail. But I think if you look at how Simon Coveney behaved, how he stuffed on board Planola's board with five new members the day before he finished up as housing minister, all of that stuff points in a particular direction. And, you know, I'd say anyone who says otherwise is just closing their eyes, like turning a blind eye to what exactly has gone on.
They're as stupid as me with Pádraig Gallagher. Like, I mean, Frank MacDonald, a friend of the Ditch, contributed to our print edition, has done some great work in this. And, you know, he sent a letter to Stephen Matthews, the Green Party TD, who is on the Housing Committee, isn't he?
Chair, I think.
Yeah, and he outlined how previous incarnations of Bord Planola, which, for all its faults, there was a certain independence to it, a certain professionalism to it, I suppose. But in the Walsh and Hyde era, and Frank MacDonald outlined this, where it just so happened that if a big developer had an SHD coming, a strategic housing development, it just so happened Paul Hyde was going to be ruling on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And again and again and again.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say, like, that Fine Gael and Paul Hyde destroyed on board Planola and destroyed, like, the reputation that they had built up over the years for, you know, integrity and independence. And then just, you know, under a decade, just completely fucking destroyed it to the extent that, like, people, I don't think, like, would have faith in on board Planola anymore. So that's very much part of Simon Coveney's legacy. But of course, nobody wants to talk about
it. I think
it's
his political legacy. I think that
great on Brexit. Great on Brexit.
Yeah, like, flagshaggers again will go, like, because, you know, he's aesthetically, I suppose, he is, you know, the antithesis of the likes of Boris Johnson. He's a very serious man, very serious. You know, he was expelled from Clongowes as a teenager. That's, like, the one funny thing I can say about him, that, like, yeah, he was expelled from, like, it was a long journey from being expelled from Clongowes to then, do you remember that thing, you know, when Brian Cowan showed up on Morning Ireland, oh, yeah, steamed or hungover, and, like, that was Coveney going on RT News going, well, I think he was either drunk or hungover. Like, so, all right, Mister, what would the boys in Clongowes say about you?
That was the one good thing that Brian Cowan ever did.
Yeah, it was good crack. Like. We're on to fans' favourite Paulie Doyle's Take of the Week, brought to you by the Kira Phelan podcast. Paulie, you've chosen a piece from the failing Business Post. Ian Guider has written it.
Yes. So the piece is titled "Harris Can't Stand Up for Small Firms and Make Work Pay at the Same Time." It's typical, I suppose, of the direction that the Business Post has been going in recent years, particularly under its new editor, where it's effectively just kind of like lobbying for the interests of elites, or, you know, property developers, banks, or in this case, kind of like business owners. And the thrust of the article is basically saying, how could Simon Harris possibly commit to helping businesses in Ireland if Fine Gael are also talking about introducing a living wage? Which strikes me as, I mean, like, surely if you can't afford to pay your staff enough money to sustain themselves, you don't actually, in fact, have a viable business model.
What would you know about business? Like,
you don't have an EU flag and a rugby ball in your bio, Polly, so what would you know?
about enterprise.
I did business studies for the Leaving Cert, which I think qualifies me.
Me too.
Profit and loss.
I could tell you the five M's of management.
What are the five M's of managing?
There's management.
Managing.
Managing.
Your manager.
Money.
Managerial.
Managerialness. This guy's also advocating basically scrap it or introduce an opt-out for businesses who can't afford to pay a living wage, which surely would defeat the purpose of having a minimum standard for people who are working. No? You can just opt out if you say, no, I can't afford it.
We have to make work pay. Hopefully Simon Harris makes work pay. Guys, thanks so much for joining us for episode 4. We'll be back again with you next week. Apologies to Ciara Phelan. We ran out of time. Hopefully we'll have you on next week and we'll hear all about the role to government buildings. Thanks so much.